From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie and welcome to Coast AM. Happy Victoria Day to our Canadian neighbors. Now, later on tonight, we're going to be talking to the Happy Medium. Also, prayers tonight to Coast guest Jordan Maxwell. Several days ago, Jordan had a heart attack. He is recuperating. He is resting. Tom had a chance to talk with him tonight. Jordan actually wants to come on the program for an hour or so to talk about things. But put him in your prayers. Jordan Maxwell had a heart attack several days ago. President Obama lifted the decades-long U.S. arms embargo against, guess where? Vietnam, in an apparent effort to shore up the communist country's defenses against an increasingly aggressive China. I am so confused with this story. Though he faced criticism that the move takes away U.S. leverage to press for human rights freedoms. So after all these years, fighting between the South and the North Vietnamese, losing well over 50,000 American soldiers, we have lifted an arms embargo against Vietnam. Ho Chi Minh came to us before the war and asked for our help. We turned him down, and that caused all those issues. But that's that story. An Egypt Air flight that crashed into the Mediterranean did not swerve and change direction before disappearing after all. The Airbus A320 was en route from Paris to Cairo with 66 people aboard when it vanished from radar early on Thursday. And there's also a report now that the pilot took the plane into a steep dive to extinguish a fire aboard the plane. That's beginning to come out right now. So people are beginning to wonder, was this some kind of mechanical failure in this plane? Listen to this story. A pilot was forced to divert a passenger plane just an hour into its flight after a screaming man attempted to light up a cigarette and open the aircraft's door at 36,000 feet. The Vancouver-bound Lufthansa flight took off from Munich but was forced to divert to Hamburg after a passenger began to behave erratically. One man on the flight said the flyer, who was later diagnosed with a mental disorder, started being difficult at the beginning of the 10-and-a-half-hour flight, but the crew decided to take off anyway. Two former Republican governors are running for president and vice president on the Libertarian Party. You don't hear too much about this. They are Gary Johnson, former New Mexico governor, and William Weld, former governor of Massachusetts. The Libertarian Party holds its nominating convention in Orlando, Florida, over the Memorial Day weekend. The Libertarian Party could play the spoiler role in the 2016 election for Donald Trump, just as Ralph Nader did in 2000, but this time helping to tip the election to the Democrat, they say. I wanted to check in with Howard Bloom on this story. Howard, the media is not talking much about the Libertarian Party, but they could grab some votes from one of the candidates.
Well, what they're hoping for, Gary Johnson, when he ran in 2012, got 1% of the vote. That's pretty pathetic. He is hoping that this year he will get 10% of the vote, which is also, it's only significant if it takes away from one of the candidates and adds or helps the other candidate
right.
get into office.
Which one would
that
it help? Do we know?
Well, okay, yes, because over the weekend there were a whole bunch of polls run by the Wall Street Journal, NBC, and everybody else who runs polls. And in those polls, a whole bunch of trial races were held in which you had Hillary against Donald with the Libertarian Party in the middle. And in every single one of those, the Libertarian Party got 10% of the vote, but it took away equally from Hillary and from Donald.
Hmm.
So it was a washout. I mean, this year, the Libertarian Party is hoping it's going to be their breakout year, because another statistic emerged over the weekend in the polls. 47% of the voters said that they would consider a third-party candidate. Well, that sounds like hot times in the old town tonight for Gary Johnson and William Weld. There's only one small problem here. Gary Johnson and William Weld are, for all practical purposes, totally unknown.
You got it.
People vote. Look at the psychological factors here. There's something called stored attention. There's another thing called queuing. You come to like and trust somebody you've heard about 10 times, 20 times, 50 times, 100 times. There are two candidates running who have 40 years of stored attention each. Donald Trump started to make headlines in the 1970s. He had a People magazine interview in 1981. That's a long time ago. He was on the Oprah show in 1988. That's a long time ago. He's been building a pyramid of stored attention. Hillary Clinton has been around in politics for the same amount of time. But mention the names of William Weld and Gary Johnson to somebody, and you get nothing but a baffled and perplexed look.
All right, Howard, thank you so much. The Libertarian Party, we'll see what happens there. A part-time Japanese pop singer is in a coma after being stabbed about 20 times by a fan near a concert site. Wouldn't really call a person a fan. They also suspect has been arrested and admitted that he intended to kill the 20-year-old. A Merrill Lynch analyst ate a handful of magic mushrooms in his Manhattan apartment Sunday morning, then plunged to his death out of his 26th-floor window. Lake Mead's water level reached a record low this week and is expected to drop further moving into 2016 as the drought-stricken region shows no signs of recovery. Lake Mead provides water for approximately 20 million residents in Arizona, California, Nevada, and is expected to drop by an additional 5 feet by the end of June. The chances are good that microbial life existed on Mars a long time ago, and sending astronauts to the red planet is the best way to find the evidence, according to a NASA chief scientist. What else is going on in space? Let's check in with space historian and our science advisor, Robert Zimmerman. Hey, Robert, welcome back.
Hey, George, glad to be here. It's funny you should be talking about Lake Mead and shorelines and Mars, because I can tell you two quick stories about shorelines on Mars and Pluto.
Sure.
Scientists have looked at a specific spot on Pluto where they think water came crashing at one point, and they looked at the formations, and they've come to the conclusion that there were two different giant tsunamis that crashed into the shoreline sometime in the past on Mars. And they think they were millions of years apart, and they could have been as high as like 120 feet. Different processes than you'd see on Earth, but nonetheless, this might explain some of the shorelines on Mars and the evidence of gigantic floods in the past there. And then you got shorelines on Pluto. I've got a picture up on Behind the Black, my website, of a weird geology that they've now spotted on Pluto, and it appears to be the kind of shoreline you might see at the edge of a nitrogen sea, in which the bedrock is made of ice, and it's very strange. They call it threaded terrain. Very weird. It only exists in one of the places. This kind of terrain only exists in one place in the solar system, and that's on Mars. And they really don't understand what's causing it, except that it looks like maybe the nitrogen glaciers are pushing the bedrock ice apart and making these strange river-like valleys in between. The universe is a strange place, George, and it would be really great to get astronauts to these places to look at them, get a closer look, because what we've got right now is a great deal of cool mystery.
You got that right. Robert, thanks. Robert's website linked up at coasttocoastam.com and part of our Twitter feed. Hundreds of pilgrims are flocking to a statue of the Virgin Mary believed to be crying a single tear of blood. The images of the statue with red liquid dripping down its cheek have been shared on social media, prompting a mass pilgrimage to Colombia. Locals believe they've witnessed a miracle, and others are swarming to catch a glimpse. Did you ever go into a magic shop when you were a kid? It is just unbelievable how it captures your attention. Up next, we'll be talking with Dr. James Doty into the magic shop. This is one incredible story. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Dr. James Doty is a neurosurgeon, entrepreneur, philanthropist as well. He is the author of Into the Magic Shop, a neurosurgeon's quest to discover the mysteries of the brain and the secrets of the heart. He is a neuroscientist who studies compassion. He's an expert on mind training and how to be your best self. He's also friends with the Dalai Lama, and here he is on Coast to Coast. Doctor, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be with you tonight.
What an amazing story. Amazing, since you were a little 12-year-old. You're going to have to tell us how you did this.
Well, it's interesting because The title is not only a literal title, but it's also a figurative title in many ways. I had grown up with a father who was an alcoholic, a mother who had had a stroke. She was paralyzed, chronically depressed, had attempted suicide. Neither had gone to college. And we were on public assistance essentially my entire life. And really, I would tell people that I felt like a leaf being blown by an ill wind. I had no control over my environment, what was going to happen to me next. And as many people know who are in that situation, it creates an immense amount of anxiety, fear, stress. And it's certainly not a prescription for success in life. Because if you don't have mentors, if you don't have access, if you don't have financial resources, it's very, very difficult to live up to your potential, especially if you're always worried what's going to happen to you next. And what happened to me at the age of 12 was I had had an interest in magic for all the reasons you had mentioned earlier. And I had been riding my orange stingray a little further than I normally would. And I happened upon a magic shop in a strip mall, and I walked in. And there was this woman who I tell people reminded me of an Earth Mother type from the 60s, and this was in 1968. And she had this radiant smile, and all of us meet people who have a presence that just radiates kindness, and she was one of those types of people. And I started asking her questions about magic, and she looked up and smiled at me, and she said, "I don't know anything about magic, at least the magic in the store." And it turned out that her son was the owner of the store, and she was simply sitting in there minding the store while her son was doing errands. But she was an incredibly perceptive person, and she began asking me some very penetrating questions, which frankly, as a 12-year-old, I did not share my background, and frankly, most people ignored me. But I answered her questions honestly, and she said to me, "You know, I really like you. I'm here for another 6 weeks, and if you show up every day, I think I can teach you something that can change your life." And again, as a 12-year-old, I wish I could tell you I had some self-awareness, but in fact, I didn't at all. In fact, the reason I came back was she had given me some cookies, and I thought she would keep giving me cookies if I would show up every day.
That's amazing. And the tricks, of course, I mean, I used to remember, James, going into magic shops as a kid, and they had all these wonderful little tricks, these little ones, these toys, making cups disappear. I mean, I was just mesmerized by it, and I guess you were too. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm sorry about that.
You disappeared. Yeah,
I know. I don't know what happened.
Did you hear anything?
Yeah, no, there was a beep, and then you were gone for a second.
Oh, that's weird. That's weird. Okay.
But maybe that's the Earth telling us something, or the there's something more going on here than we suspect.
You never know. A little bit of magic. No, I was saying how when I went into a magic shop, how mesmerized I was by all the little toys and gadgets and tricks that they had in there.
No, and I was the exact same way. And in fact, the reason I went in there was I used to have a plastic thumb that I would do tricks with, and I had lost it. And I went in there, and to make a long story short, I showed up every day. And what the amazing thing that this woman did was she made me understand that each of us has the power, an immense amount of power that often we don't realize. And over that 6 week period, she basically taught me a set of, I describe as tricks in the book, of really how to harness your mind and, if you will, be your best self and accomplish incredible tasks. I mean, as you were mentioning in my biography, here I was a 12-year-old with frankly no future. And ultimately, not only did I become a professor of neurosurgery at Stanford University, which of course is one of the top universities in the world, but I also became a successful entrepreneur, being CEO of a company that went public for $1.3 billion.
Whoa, what kind of business was that?
It was a medical device company.
Okay, all right.
And also a successful entrepreneur. But it's interesting, though, because at that young age, I did not appreciate, and I think even as adults, many people don't appreciate that when you're in pain, when you're in suffering, or when you're suffering and you have anxiety and fear about your situation, that it has a huge, huge effect on your thinking, and it distracts you from thinking clearly. And it also creates stress, which is oftentimes translated into the muscles of your body. And one of the first things that she taught me was really the recognition of this fact, and then a technique of how to gain attention and focus, and also to relax my body, and really to have awareness of this fact that so much of our emotions are transmitted to the muscles of our body. And so that was her first trick, if you will. And the other thing that is now well recognized to have success is this concept of having focus and attention. And achieving great success is very hard to do without that.
When this happened to you, and again, it started at 12.
Correct.
At that age, did it have a profound effect on you, or did you realize that later on?
Well, it had an immediate and profound effect in the sense that being with this person made me see the world in a completely different way and gave me some great insights into myself at that time that allowed me to achieve the great success that I ultimately had. In addition to this idea of attention and focus, she taught me that one of the things that happens to so many of us is that there is a dialogue that's going on in our head, and that we don't appreciate that it is in fact a, if you will, artificially created dialogue. And oftentimes for many people, it's not one of self-affirmation, it's one that is very hypercritical and not constructive. It tells you that you're not good enough, you're not smart enough, you're not attractive enough to do X, Y, or Z. And many people confuse that ongoing negative dialogue with who they are and not realizing that it is a created dialogue. And it's created by us hearing negative messages from around us. When we tell a person that we have a dream or an aspiration and they say, oh no, you'll never do that. Or you have a teacher who criticizes you or another person who criticizes you. And so what we now know from studying the brain and from neuroscience is that when you have that type of a dialogue going on in your head, it has a huge, huge effect on your peripheral physiology.
James, if you did not go into that magic shop at 12 years old, if you did not go into it, what do you think would have happened to your life?
Well, I probably would have either become a statistic, a person either destroyed by drugs or alcohol, or I would potentially be pumping gas somewhere. And don't get me wrong, there's nothing wrong with pumping gas. But that being said,
especially if you own the gas station.
or more than a gas station. No, not at all. I mean, there's nothing wrong with pumping gas. But there's a far cry from pumping gas, which is what I actually did at one point in my life, to being a neurosurgeon at a major academic medical center. Those are far different professions. And certainly, I believe, and I think most people believe, that if they had the opportunity to live up to their potential and be the best person they could be and maximize the gifts that they have, that they would prefer to do so.
Are we dealing here with the power of thinking? Is that what this is?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And in fact, that's what she taught me, was to harness your brain. In fact, I give a lecture called Hacking Your Brain for Happiness.
Okay, stay with us, Jim. We're going to take this quick break, but we're going to come right back and talk more about your work into the magic shop. And you talk about the secrets of the heart as well, so I want to get in with that with you, too. I'm George Norrie. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Boy, we've got all kinds of events coming up, by the way, all kinds coming up around my birthday, first weekend in June. We're going to be at Contact in the Desert at Joshua Tree, and I understand that there might be a little birthday party for me, though I'm not supposed to know that. So full information on that at coasttocoastam.com. When you click the highlight reel that has the events, you'll see a picture of us about the St. Louis event. That opens up the Joshua Tree event. And, of course, tickets going very quickly for our live stage show in St. Louis. So definitely participate in that. That's June 18th. Those of you in that greater St. Louis area, and I was talking to Tom today saying, did you put together a few chairs and seats for my family because they're coming? And he went, oh, my God, we need to do that yet. I think they're going to be up in the balcony. I'm not sure. So go fast. And then Asheville, North Carolina. My gosh, August 27th, another live stage show event there. Small theater, by the way. This one is quaint. Those tickets are going very quickly. It's going to be at the Diana Wortham Theater in Asheville, North Carolina. So all that is loaded up there at coasttocoastam.com. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, along with Dr. James Doty. We're talking about his work, Into the Magic Shop, with a tremendous message here. We're going to take calls with him next hour, too, by the way. If people can dig deep within themselves, like you did as a youngster, can they change their life, Doc?
Oh, that's 100% certainty. You can change any aspect of your life, whether it's losing weight, stopping drinking, stopping drugs. You just have to, in some ways, what I say is, first of all, you can't escape prison if you don't know you're in a prison. And the techniques that I describe in my book, and which I learned as a 12-year-old, but which have allowed me to have great success throughout my life, really are the key to opening that prison door. And it's actually quite extraordinary, and we know now through work that I've done and a number of neuroscientists throughout the world that there is immense power within our mind, and there are now well-established techniques, many of them actually from Eastern practices, or what we call contemplative practices, which really give you that key. As we were talking about earlier, and this idea of this dialogue going on in your head, until you realize there's a dialogue, if you will, you can't change the channel or change the dialogue, because that dialogue causes you to have an emotional response, a physiologic response, and it causes people to have an increase in their blood pressure, decrease in cardiac function, suppression of their immune system, and release of these stress hormones that, when they're chronically released, have a profound, profound effect both on health, mental and physical, but a huge effect on longevity. So we're now really beginning to understand how, if you will, we can harness the power of our mind to change our lives.
I'm going to get a little personal here with you, and if I'm getting too close, you tell me. But
sure.
Because of what you went through as a child and because of the pretty difficult family life, after you became a success, did you still deal with your family? Did you disown them? What happened?
No. First of all, what happens to many of us when we come from difficult circumstances like this, we have a tendency, as an example, to blame our parents. Like, my father was an alcoholic, mm-hmm. my mother was an invalid. I often felt ignored. But actually, spending time with this woman made me realize that they were not the issue, that they had their own struggles, and it wasn't helpful either for them or for me to be angry. And in fact, the greatest lesson, one of the greatest lessons I learned from that experience with this woman in the magic shop, is not to have that emotional reactivity to events, because it's that emotional response that has a very deleterious effect on our long-term health. And in fact, at the end of the period of time I had with this woman, frankly, my personal circumstances had not changed at all. But what profoundly changed was how I reacted to those circumstances. Because before this interaction, I had always the sense of anger, frustration, a feeling of hopelessness and despair because I was reacting to the circumstance.
Did you feel sorry for yourself?
Because I would look around and see other people have what I thought was a quote-unquote more successful or happier life. And when I stopped having attachment to that, to something that I couldn't attain at that situation or wasn't my reality, then I stopped having that type of an emotional response. And instead, I had a response of non-judgment to my present situation and also an unbiding optimism about the possibilities and an acceptance and, if you will, even a love for everyone around me because everyone struggles. And what happens to many of us is that we sort of sit with ourselves and say, geez, our problem is the worst problem. And in fact, many people have problems. And so when I accepted that reality and looked at the world through a different lens, even though my circumstances didn't change, how the world reacted to me changed. And that changed everything.
Are you a rarity, or would you say a lot of people have been able to do what you do?
Well, I'm not sure if everyone is able to achieve the same degree of success because that does have to do with their own desires, mm-hmm. their own potential,
and that's all relative too.
Absolutely, but I can 100% assure you that when you learn the type of techniques that I described, if you will, these four tricks that Ruth taught me, I can assure you 100% that everyone's life who reads that, follows those techniques, their life will improve significantly, if not dramatically and profoundly.
Let's go through some of them if we can. We're going to take some calls next hour with people who may have gone through the same things that you have gone through. I had a pretty good upbringing. You know, my parents were, you know, great. They were loving, middle class. Of course, my dad worked at Ford Motor Company as a financial analyst. And, you know, mom worked part-time at a couple retail places, home most of the time for us. Probably had a very good childhood, I guess, if I had to categorize it. Didn't have to go through the things that you went through at all. Yet it's kind of interesting. There were some individuals like Ruth was to you in the magic shop who did similar things for me in my career in broadcasting. And there was one individual who, at the age of 21, took me by his wing. So he was 9 years older than you were when the metamorphosis occurred. And, you know, he taught me things about broadcasting and about life. And in the beginning, Doctor, I hated him because he was just so intense with me. I mean, I would call in voicers over the phone covering a fire, let's say, in Detroit, 21 years old. I'd call it in, and I'd, you know, this is George Norrie reporting, and he didn't like it. And he said, redo it. And I did it, and I did it again. He said, do it again. There were sometimes he made me do it five or six times over and over again. And, you know, I came back to the station afterwards, and he had already left, and I'm just talking to some of the other reporters going, I mean, this guy's maniacal. What is he doing to me? And then one day it hit me that all he wanted me to do was be good. And we became friends after that. I'd go to dinner with him and his wife. I was a kid. I was 21 years old. And it changed my whole perspective. He died several years ago, but he touched my life immeasurably.
Well, but, you know, it's interesting you say that because these types of lessons, you know, achieving success doesn't happen overnight. Achieving greatness doesn't happen just overnight, at least in very, very rare cases. It's like the experience you had. In my own experience, it wasn't as if Ruth sat with me for 6 weeks, an hour or two every day, and then at the end of it, everything was perfect. What she did, though, was make me understand, like he made you understand, that it takes practice, it takes repetition, it takes intention. And when you do that repeatedly, then what happens is, frankly, you are creating new neural pathways that allow your brain to function at its best. And this is really the key. And what people don't appreciate is that these are things that can be learned. You learned it. It had a profound effect, which you even say right now, mm-hmm. and you remember that person. And so when people like this, teachers, mentors, give you a set of lessons and you imbue that and take it to heart, it can change everything. Now, you probably did not realize what was happening to you in the context of changing your brain and creating these neural pathways that allow you to do your work as well as you do. And really, in the case, as I describe it in my book, Ruth really laid this out in the context of these four lessons. So the first one was attention, focus, relaxing your body, because you can't be at your best if you're stressed and anxious.
No,
because what
can't.
Happens is you turn off this area we call executive control function in your frontal lobes, which is what allows you to be discerning and thoughtful, and instead you become just reactive, and that's not always the best way to achieve greatness, because you're being motivated by fear and not thinking things through. The next lesson, as I was mentioning earlier, was changing the dialogue in your head, because that dialogue creates an emotional response, which oftentimes can be very negative. And you have the ability to take it one from being hypercritical of yourself to being one of self-affirmation. When you have self-affirmation, it causes you to relax, be comfortable, and it shifts you from your sympathetic nervous system being engaged, which is what is associated with the flight or fight response, to the parasympathetic nervous system being engaged, which is associated with calmness, relaxation, improved physiologic function, improved discernment and thought, increased creativity, increased productivity, and the state of what is now called flow. And the next lesson after that, which frankly,
this would be number three, I guess, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Ruth's trick number three, if you will, which I have to be honest with you, I did not, although I understood it then, I did not incorporate it then and had some negative consequences. And that was this idea of opening your heart and recognizing that other people are suffering and being with them and helping them and wishing others the best.
Right. Good point.
And being connected and being authentic and sharing and being of service to others. Because as a 12-year-old, especially coming from poverty, I thought that what happiness was control, and that control was achieved by having money. And so what happened to me was I skipped over to her last lesson, which was this idea of clarity of intention, which is what we were just talking
mm-hmm.
about, this idea of having a vision of what you want, repeating that vision and seeing it in your mind, stating it verbally.
Sleeping on it, everything.
Exactly, and that puts it into your subconscious. It doesn't mean that you will go from point A to point B in the fastest and most straightest of lines, but it will set the circumstances so that you have the greatest likelihood of achieving your goal. There may be detours, there may be some setbacks, there may be some hills and valleys, but it puts you within the greatest likelihood of you achieving your goal. And so what I did was I took lesson one, lesson two, lesson four, and I forgot really to embrace lesson three, which was this idea of opening your heart. And what happened was that having achieved great success, being worth tens and tens of millions of dollars, driving Ferraris, Porsches, being in private jets, living in a penthouse on the top of a building, and being with all these what I thought were beautiful women and essentially having everything that many people believe is success, I woke up one day and was realized that I was as unhappy as I had ever been in my entire life.
You were like the Wolf on Wall Street.
Well, you know, I must say I had many of my friends who thought I had the perfect life because seemingly I could do anything I wanted, and I was traveling in a very interesting circle,
mm-hmm.
and I was, you know, flying all over the world and doing very interesting things, meeting very interesting people. The problem was that I wasn't connecting with people. I was not authentic. I was not being of service to people, because being of service, caring, connecting, being authentic, that is what creates meaning in life. I thought that by having money, by thinking I had control, by having everything, I really had nothing, because it was not giving me the sustenance that I needed as a human being to give my life meaning. And through a series of circumstances, which I talk about in the book, and this was during the dot-com period, I essentially lost close to $80 million in 6 weeks and was effectively bankrupt and had nothing.
Jeez.
Yes.
That's all I can say. $80 million in how long?
6 weeks.
Six weeks?
And the thing was that when I lost everything and was effectively bankrupt, you know, the bank comes calling when you owe them money, when they know you don't have the money, and I had to essentially sell everything.
Yeah.
But a circumstance happened that really allowed me then to overcome that and realize that this Ruth's lesson number three, or trick number three, was in fact the most important thing that I learned. And what happened was that when I had lost everything, I had made some obligations to charity, and I had no ability to love to them except for the only asset left was stock in this medical device company, which I mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
And what I did was to live up to those obligations, and it's funny because I had asked many of my friends what I should do. Everyone said you should not live up to those obligations at all. Just forget it.
Yeah.
But I felt I had an obligation. I said I would do it. So I gave stock away. My only asset left in this medical device company that had yet to go public. And when it went public, I gave every share away, I ended up giving $30 million away to charity.
That's amazing. And this was though, this was your company?
Yes, yes. And so what I say is that it is only when I lost everything that I gained everything.
Right. And you learned from this. Big
Absolutely.
Time. Absolutely. Big time.
And that event, that decision to give, allowed me to create health clinics all over the world. It allowed me to create a center actually at Stanford that studies the neuroscience of the behaviors we're talking about, of compassion, of altruism, and the power those behaviors have not only to profoundly affect our physiology in a very, very positive way that results in mental and physical health, increase in longevity, but also made me understand, and in fact is a reality, that these types of behaviors are what give us meaning in our lives. And chasing after wealth and a collection of things never does that. It is only when you are of service to others, when you connect with others, that you are really truly happy. And there's actually an evolutionary reason for that, because as a species, to have something we call theory of mind, to have abstract thinking, have complex language, required our cortex to increase in size, which limited the size of our litter, if you will, but also created an absolute requirement that our offspring are cared for 15 to 20 years after they're born. And the cost of that is incredibly high in terms of resources and energy.
Doctor, stay with us. We're going to take this quick break. We're going to come right back. We're going to take phone calls, but we'll continue talking about your work, a neurosurgeon's quest to discover the mysteries of the brain, the secrets of the heart, into the magic shop.